So this is our reading group on Rie's book, Cybernetics and the Origin of Information. We are picking up from page 43 of the translation, and this is should be the last session on chapter one of the book. So the title of the chapter is The Main Types of Information Machines. And so he's essentially going through the different ways you can use information to or the different ways you can set up a machine that uses information in some way. And of course, in some sense, every machine involves information. Like it, you know, whatever machine you're building is going to, in some sense, respond differently to different types of things. Even if it's like, I don't know, a pulley, it, like this extremely simple machine, it will either be able to lift something or not be able to lift something. And depending on how heavy it is, so you could say it's like, in some sense, responding differently to the weight of the object to lift. It's sort of in a sense taking in information about how heavy this object is and responding differently. But of course, how useful it is to describe the machine in terms of information will vary depending on what type of machine it is. So in the case of the pulley, it's probably not that helpful to describe it as like taking in information about the weight of the object to lift. But in the case of like these anti-aircraft guns, for example, that we've talked about a few times, it's pretty much essential to understand the reception of information about the trajectory of the object to target. Like you can't really understand what the machine is doing unless you sort of take account of this information reception function. So at the time he's writing in, so the first edition is 58, I believe, in the 50s at least. There are, of course, digital computers, which we're familiar with from today, but there were a bunch of other types of information machines that were also in use. So you had these analog computers that were still quite prevalent at the time. So in an analog computer, rather than having like a set of bits with a zero or one value, you have a continuous signal of some kind. So a lot of them at this time would have been electronic analog computers. So if you're trying to model, like if you're trying to have a computer predict what the tide will look like at a given time, you would have some sort of electric circuit set up in such a way that the changes in the electric current would sort of correspond in some way to the level of the tide. And so if you want to know what's the tide going to be, you know, at, 3 p.m. on December 22nd, then you would like sort of run your electric circuit to or set it to the right sort of parameters. And then you would measure what the current, what the level of the current is at that time. And then you can use that to predict the level of the tide. And then another sort of example of this that he mentions here is this network analyzer system where you have like, you want to model the operation of an electric power network. You have like different power plants, transmission lines, you know, different like maybe factories or other big facilities that are drawing a lot of power from the system. And then you want to sort of model what happens if one of the power plants is damaged or one of these transmission lines goes down or whatever. And then so you can sort of simulate that in your analog system. It's like a scale model of the real system. And then you can sort of predict, you know, what will happen, you know, what are the best ways to respond to this kind of event happening and so on. So this is like, it's still an information machine in the sense that you're interested in this machine, not because of the actual sort of physical effect it produces, but for what it tells you about something else happening in the world. But it's not a digital computer because it doesn't involve this discrete 0-1 sort of operation. But what they sort of share, what's common to these types of machines and all the information machines that Rie talks about is that they kind of they abstract from anything like a human interpretation or understanding of a situation. So like your network analyzer is just a physical system with current that flows in different ways based on the design of the system. And then the human who is operating it or observing it or measuring it will then sort of understand this system as like providing information about the functioning of the actual power grid out in the world, but the system itself is just, you know, a set of circuits through which electric current flows. It doesn't itself have any understanding of the power grid that it's supposed to be a model of. And for like the cybernetic the cyberneticians that Ruyer is talking about, they essentially want to explain the human capacity to understand things in general, and also other animals' capacities to understand things, in terms of these information machines, or like modeled after these information machines that are not themselves capable of understanding. So if we want to understand how it is that a human can, you know, look at this network analyzer and use it to learn something about the electrical power grid, and, you know, make decisions that are appropriate to the conditions of that grid, then we have to sort of analyze the human nervous system and brain and so on in terms of these of similar types of information machines that do not themselves exhibit understanding. And so Ruyer goes through a bunch of like sort of increasingly sophisticated forms, like and more of these the ones that have these more cybernetic sort of design that involve like feedback loops and sort of dynamic equilibrium, where you have these in some cases quite simple systems where you set things up in such a way that the device sort of exhibits something that looks like goal-directed behavior. Like he talks about this sort of artificial tortoise that, you know, behaves as if it were an organism that seeks a charging station to ensure that its battery stays charged, but also to avoid light that's too strong. And so it sort of simulates like a simple kind of animal behavior that you might observe in a worm or something like that, that, you know, seeks out food sources, but also wants to avoid potential dangers and has to balance those competing impulses. And sort of the cybernetic project was that you could like take these sort of simulations of simple animal behavior and just make them sort of more sophisticated and more complex, and eventually you would capture, you know, all the most sophisticated human behaviors. You'd be able to sort of build up these feedback loops and dynamic equilibrium processes to eventually produce a device that would, you know, compose symphonies and write novels and whatever, all the things that we consider to be some of the most sophisticated human behaviors. And so Ruyer, I think, is like skeptical of the sort of empirical feasibility of this project. He doesn't really think that this is something that is going to succeed. But he's also sort of insisting on like an in principle difference, that even if you did produce an artificial device, like, you know, an information machine that was capable of sort of simulating or reproducing human behavior in these like more sophisticated domains, it would still it would not be the same kind of performance as a human being performing these activities. It would be just a simulation, or like a simulacrum of the human performance. And I think this is especially interesting today when we think about like you have these like automatic translation functions that are actually pretty good at this point. You can take a text in French or German or whatever. It's, you know, the quality varies depending on the language and how much content there is on the internet for it to use, of course. But you can take a text and feed it into, you know, DeepL or Google Translate or whatever, and get a pretty decent translation in English back within a few seconds. Even though, of course, this machine, this, you know, system is not doing anything like a human translator, where the human translator sort of understands the text in French and then generates a text in English that is, you know, has a similar meaning. The computer translation system is just, you know, based on this sort of probabilistic analysis of like, you know, this sequence of words in language A has like a similar distribution, statistical distribution, as the sequence of words in language B. And then it just sort of generates a text that, you know, matches these statistical properties. It has no like, there's nothing within DeepL that does anything resembling understanding the text in question. So the question that, the sort of like core question of this book, I think, is like, can we assume that this sort of increasing sophistication and, you know, more and more sophisticated like pattern recognition functions in these information machines is sort of will eventually sort of capture what a human is doing when they understand a text or a piece of music or whatever. Is it just sort of a quantitative difference between our, you know, existing information machines and human capacity to understand, you know, intellectual or semantic properties of something? And this is Rie's position, or is there a difference in principle or a difference in kind between these kinds of asemantic or non-semantic manipulation of information that machines are capable of, and then the semantic capacity to understand something that a human exhibits? I think to some extent there's just a sort of like insistence on a principle. Like, you can't really, I'm not sure there's a way to give like a good argument to say yes or no, that whether you can understand this human capacity to grasp to understand something or to grasp the significance of something in terms of these like intrinsically meaningless information manipulation operations. I think it's sort of like a decision you have to make, as opposed to something you can like give an argument for one side or the other. But anyway, so that's what we're going to be looking at throughout this book. And so the first chapter is essentially just going through all these different types of information machines and, sort of pointing to where their weaknesses are, I think, or like where they sort of don't quite show us what a lot of these cyberneticians wanted them to show us, I think is what he wants to do in this first chapter. Okay, so we can pick up from page 43 at the, 43 at the top of the page, I think is where we were. If someone would like to read from there.
I can read.
It is clear that a simple self-regulating automaton only appears to imitate the quote-unquote law of effect. The thermostat seems to be looking for a given temperature. Once this temperature is reached, it seems quote-unquote satisfied, since it maintains it. A DCA cannon with radar also looks for its objective until it has obtained the quote-unquote satisfactory effect. But for one to be able to talk about learning or conditioning, this quote-unquote satisfaction would have to concern the means and not just the goal. The living being knows how to find the most expedient means. Quote, pressing the bar, unquote, for the rat is an act, quote-unquote, valued through success. A secondary automation must then necessarily be superimposed on the primary automation so that the brain imitates the living being. The secondary automation would itself work on information, but on statistical information about successful moves. In short, it would be able to induce. However, as we have seen, induction machines, without being inconceivable, are very difficult to realize. Not to say that it is extremely doubtful that this would be authentic induction and therefore true learning. The problem might be a little less difficult if it were not a question of quote-unquote satisfaction and induction, but of a simple application of what Thorndike calls the, quote, law of exercise, unquote. The influence of repetition, quote-unquote recency, and quote-unquote frequency, a law which is, in fact, far from being unanimously accepted today. Wiener, again, probably not satisfied with the aforementioned hypothesis and relying on recent research from the Eindhoven laboratories of the Philips company, gives a general idea of what automatic learning based on this law could be. If I call a colleague or a close friend 20 times a day, automatic telephone, the procedure for the call is just as complicated as that for calling an occasional correspondent. A living being in a similar situation would soon find faster alternatives for the often repeated action. It would be necessary then that the apparatus of the automatic telephone records the relative frequency of the numbers called and modifies its own assembly through second-degree feedback for the, quote, most frequent calls, unquote. We appreciate the extreme difficulty of mechanically making a device that modifies itself in the other than by simple mechanical wear. Simple wear can sometimes be equivalent to improvement, but the running in of an engine, the softening of new shoes, or the increase in capacity of a battery after use cannot be considered to be authentic cases of learning. However, cybernetics does not give up on tackling the problem, even in cases where induction is necessary. Take again the DCA cannon with automatic aim. To avoid projectiles, the targeted aviator will modify his line of flight, but he cannot modify it ad libitum. He is dependent on the centrifugal force and the characteristics of the aircraft, which prevent him from making very sudden turns.
A human aimer would get used to these evasive moves and would shoot shots accordingly. However, a device can also do this by feedback of the second degree, superimposed on the automatic functioning of the first degree, and functioning with statistical information of the most common evasive moves of the aircraft. Another conceivable method for the method of approach for the problem of learning has been attempted. It starts from the fact that a negative feedback can be more or less efficient. That is, it can stabilize its oscillations more or less quickly. Certain systems can only be stabilized following their test by at least two feedbacks, not only one. An auxiliary feedback can test the characteristics that it would be necessary for the principal feedback to have in order to render the system stable in a given circumstance. This is equivalent to a sort of learning. One can take, for example, the way we behave when we walk or drive on an icy road. All our ways of walking or driving depend on our knowledge of the degree adherence of the road, or in other words, of some, quote, oscillatory characteristics, unquote, of the pedestrian road system or car road system. If we drive with the authority of our usual manner, going into the ditch. So while driving, we make a series of small steering movements, insufficient to make the vehicle skid dangerously, but sufficient for us to be continually informed of how the vehicle is responding. We then adapt the way we drive in response. A, quote, feedback informing a feedback, unquote, can be added to an automaton. It is, however, doubtful that it is a matter of true learning here. It's only a matter of an automatic choice between two pre-existing assemblies. Maybe I'll stop there. So I guess in terms of the argument of the book, he's trying to show here that mechanistic cybernetics has trouble explaining learning. Some of these examples do seem a little bit dated to me. I don't think it is, you know, difficult to automatically change, for instance, like an Instagram feed on the basis of feedback from, you know, what the user is, the post the user tends to engage with. That curation is automated and seems to be the kind of second order feedback that Rouillet here seems to think is not possible. Although he may still insist that, for reasons other than what he seems to see as like this empirical impossibility, it still, you know, is not authentic learning, although I'm not sure what exactly his argument would be there.
Yeah, so, yeah, like I was mentioning in the sort of intro part, that there's sort of two types of argument that he is making here. Is sort of, one is just the empirical argument that, you know, there are these phenomena that human learning, that humans are capable of doing in learning that machines are not capable of. And of course, the domain of those kinds of human learning capacities that machines are not capable of has gotten much smaller in the time since he was writing. Of course, we have, you know, machines that can learn how to identify pictures, in some cases better than humans at this point, identify a voice from a recording, or to, you know, identify the words spoken in a recording, you know, pick out music, like, you know, of course we have Shazam that can identify what, you know, piece of music is being played and so on. So all these kinds of learning tasks that at the time he was writing were, of course, far beyond the capacity of these information machines that existed, are today like things that you can, you know, run on your phone, that you carry around in your pocket with you at all times. The sort of like empirical argument is probably a lot less convincing today than it was in the 1950s. But then there's this sort of in principle argument that even if you suppose that these information machines, if you suppose that you would have like an information machine that would exhibit the same kind of general learning ability as a human, that you would sort of insist that no, this is still just a simulation of learning. It's not the same kind of thing as what humans are doing when they learn. So it is, I think, the more sort of general these kinds of learning abilities become, the less convincing that position is. Part of what he's sort of focusing on is the fact that these, even the existing learning types of process or something like learning that machines were capable of at the time he was writing, these sort of inductive machines that he's talking about, they were like learning or a simulation of learning in a very limited domain that like you would be able to sort of input, you know, trajectories of airplanes and have it figure out what the likely, you know, it would learn, I guess, like what an airplane trajectory looks like. But if you tried to input like music or, you know, chessboard configurations or whatever, it would just like give you an error message or I don't know, blow up or something. I don't know. It would have no way of like sort of taking its capacity to learn airplane trajectories and then like applying that same capacity to chessboard configurations. Whereas, of course, a human can, you know, to varying degrees, learn both airplane trajectories and chessboard configurations and, you know, millions of other things. So I think as more general learning capacities come to be realized in machines, it starts to be less convincing to think that what these machines are doing is, you know, it is not sort of in some sense learning, or it is not learning in the proper sense. It's just a sort of simulation of learning. But at the same time, I think it is worth sort of recognizing that even our much better, you know, learning machines or machine learning systems that we have now are still generally pretty domain specific. So like you have an image recognition, machine learning system. If you start trying to input music into it, it would just be like the wrong file format, or it would, you know, give you some bizarre results where it would like try to interpret an audio file as an image and of course produce nonsense. We obviously have much better machine learning now than we did in 1958 or whatever, but it's still generally pretty domain specific, and there is not, you know, even the things like ChatGPT that, you know, in certain respects are pretty sophisticated, they're still only, you know, limited to specific domain types of learning. And, you know, like ChatGPT can't learn how to throw a frisbee, for example, because it doesn't even have a body to do that, right? Or even if you tried to get it to control, you know, a robot arm or something, it's just not trained on the type of data that would make that possible. The sort of empirical, you know, gap between what machines are capable of learning and what humans are capable of learning is still there. It's just that it's maybe less, it's less obvious because we have these more specialized machines that are capable of, you know, either, you know, in some cases better than human performance in specific tasks, in other cases, like pretty good approximations to human performance. In others, of course, you know, especially in things that involve like manipulating physical objects, the performance is still pretty far from the level of humans. I remember seeing something about like Amazon warehouses where they have these like giant warehouse shelving stacks, and then you have a robot that sort of retrieves things. But like the sort of last step of like picking up the object is still something that humans are better than this sort of robotic retrieval system at performing, because the types of objects that you might have to pick up are so varied that like a robot that is good at picking up, a book, would not be good at picking up a t-shirt or, you know, a coffee mug or whatever. Like all the like thousands of different things that Amazon sells, humans are capable of using the correct grip strength and, you know, orientation, whatever, to pick up these objects. But like still today, that there's no, robot arm controlled by a computer that is like, capable of picking up all these different types of objects as well as a human. So there still is this empirical gap, despite the obviously much, much better performance in learning compared to when Rie was writing.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. One thing I was thinking of when I was reading that section, you know, we can, I think, easily imagine a program some like digital calling service that would learn how frequently you call certain numbers and, recommend, most frequently dialed numbers, to you when you open up the application or whatever. But as an example of like this, kind of semantic gap, I guess, you can imagine a situation where you had some issue with your bank, for instance, for like a couple of weeks, and you were calling, calling the bank as frequently as you were calling your partner. And then you if you finally get the bank issue resolved, for you, it may be sort of completely behind you and in the past, no longer, the number of the contact at the bank is no longer relevant to you, but, for the application which recommends what it assumes to be like important numbers on the basis of like call frequency, the bank number may still be like equally as important as the phone number of like your partner or your family or these other contacts which have much greater and like significantly different like affective weight for you. Thinking of an example that might not rely on this empirical deficiency, which is no longer really accurate. And maybe another example is Facebook will recommend that you reach out to people who have passed away because you haven't reached out to them for a while, but obviously your relationship to them is not just a certain frequency of contact and qualitatively changes significantly away. But it's just the program is completely ignorant or agnostic of these aspects.
Yeah, I think those are interesting examples. So the phone app one, yeah, you can, it's completely within, I don't know of any phone app that does this, but it's completely within the realm of what is technically possible today to have the phone app see how often you call people and then suggest, do you want to call X when you open the app because this is the person that you are likely to call. And it could even be more sophisticated, at a certain time of day you're likely to call this person, all the music streaming or YouTube and all these apps do stuff like that, they evaluate not just are you likely to to watch this video, but are you likely to video at this time of day after having watched this other type of video, etc. So all these sort of statistical analyses of what type of person or what type of profile is likely to watch this type of video, based on its the past history of the profile, the time of day, all these location, all sorts of other bits of data that it can, evaluate. This is obviously much more sophisticated learning than the kinds of things that Huye was familiar with. But at the same time, it's still very shallow learning. So this bank example, maybe over the course of a couple weeks, you are calling the bank five times a day to try to get those problems solved. But then after that, you have no reason to call the bank anymore. Your relationship to the bank has changed, and having the phone app suggest the bank every time you open the app would be kind of annoying. I think maybe the cybernetician could respond that you just need a second order learning process to add on to the first order learning, so you would not just sort of look at how often you call these different numbers, but also is there a pattern, if you never called this number for years, and then all of a sudden you're calling it five times a day over the course of several weeks, and then stop calling it. Maybe that's a statistical pattern that indicates that you are interacting with this phone number, for a specific purpose. As opposed to say a number that you call, several times a week over the course of many years, which would indicate a different pattern, that this is someone that you have a long-term relationship with of some kind. Rather than someone that you interact with to deal with a certain problem, so maybe it would treat those numbers differently and sort of drop the first number down your recommended numbers list faster than the other number that you call on a frequent basis over many years. So you could have like more sophisticated forms of learning that would not just sort of, you know, give like a list of, you know, most frequently called numbers, but would look at like, you know, what is the pattern of calling this number over time, and, you know, treat numbers differently depending on, you know, whether there's like a concentrated burst of calling this number many times in a short period, or like a sustained, contact with this number over a long period of time. I think even that probably would not really be like beyond the realm of technical possibility. If you wanted to, you know, design an app to do that, I think it would be possible to do that today. but of course, like any sort of, preset form of learning that you build into your app will eventually sort of reach a limit where it will still do something like pretty dumb because it doesn't understand your, like, it doesn't have any real understanding of what kind of relationship you have with the person on the other end of the phone line. You can make it more and more sophisticated, but you eventually will reach a limit where it will like just it will make a prediction that doesn't make any sense, and that any human would say this is like not a good prediction, just because it is like only relying on the, you know, statistical properties of your interactions with this phone number, as opposed to having some sort of grasp of the value of your relationship with this person or significance of your relationship with this person. So like the Facebook example of like, you know, suggesting you send a message to someone that you know is dead, like that's a pretty good example of like making a suggestion that doesn't make any sense and might actually be pretty like harmful to the person who receives it. Like, oh, do you want to send your dead partner a message on Facebook? So you could obviously have like a better, like, you know, if Facebook decided that they were like, you know, not, didn't want to, you know, make that kind of suggestion, that would be pretty likely to get like people to either leave Facebook or, you know, send angry messages to the Facebook administrators or whatever. Maybe they can, you know, develop some sort of more sophisticated learning that would figure out that the person is dead and not suggest this person to their contacts. But again, like that's just one, like it would be kind of like a band-aid solution where you could keep sort of building on more and more complicated like learning processes to like plug these holes that come up as you implement or as you like have this learning system sort of being applied to the Facebook network. But each time you would sort of plug one hole, there would still be like other holes that you hadn't thought about that would, you know, you'd only sort of find out about it when people complain that, like, you know, this learning system is learning something that it should not learn, or is like making suggestions that don't make any sense. Kind of an aside, but there's that Black Mirror episode where there's like this company offering a service where they will like, you know, reproduce your dead partner's like online interactions with you, that they sort of like scan all your emails and texts and whatever with this person, and then like produce a sort of like simulacrum personality, and you can, you know, continue the conversation with this dead person. And I actually just heard recently that there's a company that is offering this service now. I suspect it's probably not very good at this point, but so you can like hand over your dead parent or dead partner or whatever, like their, you know, email inbox to this company, and then it will like compose emails from this person to you, you know, based on learning, I guess, like the writing style and whatever of this person. I don't really understand why someone would want to pay for that service, but you can imagine, Facebook, you know, 5-10 years from now, maybe like rolling this out as like just sort of an automatic part of the, what they offer as, you know, at their, you know, social media platform, right? That it would, sort of constantly analyze your posts and messages and so on, and then when you die, it would just keep posting in your name, and no one would even know that you're dead necessarily. Like, I don't know, people that you, I don't know, friends from high school that you haven't actually interacted with for 20 years, that, you know, whether this person is actually like enjoying their brunch at some restaurant you never heard of, or whether it's just like Facebook, you know, generating a post that resembles what they would have posted if they were alive, like it'd be hard to tell, you know, from a distance with someone that you've never talked to in years. Exactly. Like I was thinking of exactly of that. So in the William Gibson novel Neuromancer, there's this simulation of the personality of, you know, this dead sort of hacker that like, yeah, they sort of like analyzed the, I guess, behavior of this person and produced this like automated replica of the person that is sort of used to, you know, guide the main character of the book. So this like simulated person or this replicated person, at one point compares himself to a phantom limb that he says it's like his whole existence is like this missing thumb of the person that, Dixie Flatline. Yeah. That's the character's name. So he's like talking about how he, knew someone who had a missing thumb and, the missing thumb was itching and he couldn't scratch this missing thumb. And he compares himself to this, his whole existence to this, you know, phantom limb, you know, itching, missing thumb. His reward that he asked for, you know, helping with this project is to, be deleted. It's a very strange, circumstance, but it's not, I think, that far from, you know, where things are now. It's not impossible to imagine that something like this could exist in a few years as like a, you know, a widely available service or even something, like I said, that Facebook decides to roll out to everyone. I don't know how we're going to, as a society, how we're going to handle these like digital ghosts that like, you know, replicate an existing person that is dead. Something that I think Rie would have probably found pretty disturbing.
Yeah, along those lines, you see people, I haven't tried these websites, but they are like AI, supposed to be like AI simulations of, famous like intellectual figures or actors or celebrities. And of course, the things that people share on like Twitter, for instance, are things that the AI has gotten like grotesquely wrong or just, you know, seem completely uncharacteristic. Which is just kind of goes to what we're talking about with the inability to may get some things right, but the inability to kind of plan for all eventualities. And, obviously these simulations making mistakes that the actual figure would not have made.
Yeah, because like, so say you want to have like, you know, your conversation with Albert Einstein or something, and like you can, so I don't know, ChatGPT or maybe you have like more specialized tools that would sort of analyze the corpus of writings that you know Einstein left behind. But then if you ask it like, you know, what do you think about Donald Trump, of course there's not going to be anything in the Einstein corpus that you can, you know, use to make that assessment. So the computer has to just sort of make something up, and there's no reason to think that it would actually produce something that is like a realistic, production of what Einstein might have said about Trump. It might decide that Einstein would really have loved Donald Trump and would think he's a great guy. The real person, you know, obviously Einstein was dead before, probably before Trump was born, I'm not sure, or at least before he was, you know, an adult and a prominent political figure. So Einstein never had the opportunity to form an opinion about Trump, but you can, like, you know, a human who, like, reads Einstein's writings and, you know, biographies of him and so on, you can sort of extrapolate from his, you know, stated political positions and so on to, like, what he might have thought of Donald Trump and make a sort of reasonable assessment, this is what would have happened if, you know, this counterfactual was realized. Whereas the computer is just sort of, you know, doing some statistical analyses of the existing text and then producing another text that has like certain statistical relationships with the existing corpus. And it has no actual understanding of, you know, what his political positions were, what his personality was, and so on, that the way that a human would do that kind of, you know, extrapolation. So there's no, you know, when you extrapolate to these like situations that are very different from the what is in the corpus that the AI is learning from, then like the ability to make that extrapolation is gets worse and worse the more the situation sort of varies from what is depicted in the corpus, or that it, you know, is connected to the corpus. And yeah, this is a good point that, that Angus had made in the chat, that like you have these like fictional characters in a novel, for example, and you know, if it's a good novel, some like some you have these characters, you know, Sherlock Holmes or something, that like take on a life of their own, you know, long after the author is dead. That like, you know, Sherlock Holmes is sort of as much of a person in a certain sense as, say, Julius Caesar, who was a real person that existed in a certain time and place. Whereas, of course, Sherlock Holmes never existed in that sense, but like this sort of personality that was created by an author, that this fictional personality is now like sort of, you know, has a life in a sense that is sort of, it is kind of endowed with the life by all the people that have, you know, wrote, you know, subsequent stories about Sherlock Holmes or depicted Sherlock Holmes in you know, TV and movies and so on. Whereas like, even if you sort of give ChatGPT the prompt, like, you know, answer me as if you were Sherlock Holmes, and you have a conversation with it, it's not especially convincing. Most of the time it just sort of gives like, you know, it's kind of like a sort of not very good, like pastiche. You might imagine like a, I don't know, first year English student writing, you know, when they don't, when they're sort of approaching the deadline and don't have much time to do anything better than this like very superficial copy. So yeah, there's like a difference between this, you know, human production of, I guess, this creative production that a human is capable of, you know, producing essentially a personality, producing a fictional person that, you know, other people can actually, you know, bring to life or continue the life of, you know, after the author's death, versus this sort of artificial simulacrum of a person that you can get through ChatGPT or similar tools that can only really sort of operate based on like a limited corpus and will start doing things that are like extremely, you know, incorrect or inappropriate as soon as you start to depart from the domain that it is connected to through that corpus. So yeah, there's still that, yeah, that empirical gap between what humans are capable of doing and what the even fairly sophisticated AI systems are capable of doing. Okay, so we can go on to the next bit. I think we're at the top of 44, right? Another conceivable method. Oh no, sorry, you read that one, didn't you?
Yeah.
Are we at the next
I can't remember.
Okay, I'll just start from
there. Wait, I think it's we have thought.
Okay, yeah, I'll start from there. It's not a big deal if we reread something we read before. Okay. We have thought of still other methods, in particular those that equip Gray Walter's tortoise with the capacity to learn, namely the learning represented by the well-known process, quote, the burnt hand is afraid of the fire, unquote. We can put a fuse on the approach circuit of the tortoise. If it makes contact with a burning object, the fuse melts and breaks the circuit of the approach mechanism, and another backup mechanism comes into action. If the tortoise crashes into the burning object too often and too violently, the effects of the shock can be accumulated, for example, on an irreversible spring mechanism, which eventually triggers a device for bypassing the obstacles without touching them. However, it is apparent that in these methods, the learning is quote-unquote cheating. They only work once and are anticipated by the constructor. They are quote-unquote cheating, like the pseudo-intelligent acts of a trained animal. Shannon, among many others, is currently trying to solve the problem of the automatic telephone learning to make more frequent calls. To begin, he has very recently focused on a, quote, automatic mouse, unquote, that, quote-unquote, learns a maze. It first wanders the maze, groping around, and only arrives at the end after a lot of trial and error. But since the device is endowed with a memory, if we then put the mouse back at the starting point, it arrives at the end without error. Before Shannon, Albert Ducros had made a similar device. The problem of automatic learning is thus apparently solved, but this is only apparent. The mouse is guided by a control mechanism with which a pre-established program conducts a systematic exploration of the maze, which is divided into squares. An automatic memory records the success in each of the squares and the order of these squares. The memory can then serve as a program for the following performance of the device, which guides the magnetic mouse without error. It is obviously not a question of learning, but of mechanical memory, the possibility of which is not denied by anyone. Doubtless we will soon achieve other impressive imitations of learning as we have achieved impressive imitations of perception. But imitation alone is not interesting. What would count would be an authentic, quote-unquote, model of the phenomenon. The theory of learning is, along with the theory of universals, the weakest part of cybernetics. Experimental psychology has demonstrated that learning clearly involves something other than the implementation of functioning, or even the assembly of new nervous circuits, or the reorganization of the perceptual field, according to the laws of common, that is, macroscopic dynamics. Animal learning, as has been demonstrated, notably by E.S. Russell, always takes place on the ground of an instinctive Umwelt and is part of an oriented and quote-unquote co-native activity, which aims at the satisfaction of a need. The animal puts the accent of quote-unquote value or quote-unquote importance on some detail that it first ignored. Quote, success, however achieved, directs the animal's attention to the significant features of the perceptual field, those which are significant as means to the end pursued. There seems to be a missing close quotation here. Not sure where exactly it's supposed to be. Okay, open quotes. The perceptual field is organized with respect to these significant features, and when the same situation is presented again, the field retains its special organization. The animal sees it again in this special way. It is therefore able to repeat the solution, for it now perceives the situation in the light of its first success. End quote. In short, cybernetics misses the point of learning as it does of the universal, because in both cases it is impossible to imitate meaning mechanically. On the other hand, finally, the interpretations of learning proposed by Wiener would, strictly speaking, only take into account reflexes learned, quote, in response, unquote, and not, quote-unquote, operant reflexes, to use Skinner's terminology. With the automaton, the response that is learned would always be consistent with the response that is not learned. But the animal often changes its method in the process of learning. It attempts some different operations when the first have failed. For example, the cat pulls instead of pushing. The monkey that can no longer find the stick tries to break the bars of the cage or begs the caretaker. From this point of view, the schemas of Gray-Walter would appear to have the advantage over Wiener's. This is because the automata, once perfected with some filing mechanisms, moves from one process to another by putting a process that has failed out of operation. But this advantage is only apparent. In an electrical installation, we can easily predict the automatic starting of an auxiliary motor in the case of the primary motor breaking down. No one, however, would be tempted to speak of the learning of an electrical power station. In the Nividik lighthouse, which does not have a caretaker, a siren automatically replaces the light in the case of fog, and a flare gun automatically replaces the siren if it stops sounding. But no one speaks of learning in this case any more than they would for the automatic telephone message, quote, please refer to the new telephone directory, unquote. Truth be told, the cyberneticians could respond then that an organism also possesses a limited repertoire of possible operations. The cat can only chew, scratch, push, pull, or meow. Indeed, animal learning usually consists of calling successively on virtual activities that a state of alert sets in motion. But for man, at least, the new operations possible are indefinite in number. Let us consider, for example, the variety of means a person who is cold can use to warm themselves. Go for a run, put on some warmer clothes, go to bed, buy an electric radiator, do Swedish gymnastics, prepare some hot tea, drink alcohol, go to the cinema, take the subway, eat more food, go to the south, use the Kue method, auto-suggestion, and so forth. I don't know what the Kue method is. It sounds like some kind of like self-hypnosis or something. I'm not sure. And I'm also not sure what Swedish gymnastics are in relation to other kinds of gymnastics. Maybe these are like 1950s like pop culture things that are not obvious to 2024 readers. But yeah, so the sort of general idea in this passage, I think, is like what we've been talking about, this sort of open-ended nature of human learning in opposition to the like sort of fixed repertoire, even of these more sophisticated, forms of learning that you might imagine that these machines would be capable of doing. You have this thermostat, for example, that, you know, measures the temperature in the room and turns on the furnace. Obviously, this is a very simple mechanism. You can imagine a more sophisticated one where, like, maybe it, can check whether the furnace has actually turned on or not. And if the furnace is not working, it will, send a message to the repair company that will come and fix the furnace. Or if that message to the repair company is not received, maybe it will put in an order on Amazon to buy a space heater. Or, you know, you can imagine more and more complicated, like, contingency plans. But it would still be like a limited stock that, like, once you go through plans A through X, for example, then it just has no more options they can try. Whereas a human could, in principle, decide I'm going to, break my table and use it as firewood. I'm going to, buy a plane ticket to go to the Caribbean, or, any number of different things to, solve the problem of being too cold. The human being doesn't have like a fixed stock of potential solutions to the cold problem. The human can, you know, actually invent a solution that is not, you know, sort of pre-given. So I think what Rie wants to sort of insist on is that even these more and more sophisticated, supposed learning processes in machines are still just sort of like a fixed stock of, you know, solutions or potential solutions to a problem. And you sort of miss that open-ended capacity for learning and invention, which is sort of continuous with learning in the case of human beings. And of course, he's not going to deny that humans do have like this sort of, you know, preset repertoire of, you know, solutions to a problem. Like if you're in your apartment and you realize it's too cold, you don't have to sort of invent a solution, a new solution each time this problem happens. You like first go to the thermostat and turn the temperature up. Like this is sort of like a mechanistic response that you have learned, that you have this like acquired habit that like, if it's too cold, turn the thermostat up. But if you sort of notice that, you know, the thermostat says it's set to 25, but it's still freezing in this room, then you would like, I don't know, call the super of the building or like check if your space heater is working, or you would like, you know, improvise in response to the failure of your first sort of preset solution, whereas the thermostat only has this fixed repertoire, you know, of potential responses to the solution, and then once it exhausts that repertoire, it just has no way of handling the situation. So this sort of open-ended capacity to learn and improvise and invent is sort of the in principle difference between human grasp of a situation and sort of understanding in relation to a value of some kind, in this case the value of, you know, you could say comfort or not being cold or something like that, as opposed to the machine has just this like pre-built stock of responses that could be, you know, an extensive list of alternate solutions if the first one doesn't work, but still at some point that set of solutions will run out, and then it will just be, you know, ineffective at solving this problem.
One of the things that I've found striking about this book is, I mean, obviously a lot of the empirical arguments he makes are very outdated, and there's been a lot of technological development since 1956 or whenever it was, or even 67, I think it was the second edition. But, you know, we've been able to find applications for a lot of these major points that he makes, in his criticisms of mechanistic cybernetics, to contemporary technology as well. I think that before starting the book, I assumed that it would be a lot more difficult to apply it to kind of contemporary technological. I do think that, you know, technological development has blunted the force of some of these arguments, but I guess I'm just impressed that many of them still hold up, even if they have to be like schematized to fit contemporary technology.
Yeah, I remember when we were like discussing what to read next after we finished the Merleau-Ponty book, and we were talking about this one, and you had asked me about like, you know, how much relevance it had to like contemporary AI, you know, topics, and I said probably not that much, because, you know, cybernetics was kind of a competitor to like the AI program of research. And kind of like an alternate path that ended up not really being followed after, I don't know, maybe the 1960s. I think I was probably wrong about that, because a lot of the sort of contemporary wave of AI stuff has to do with the learning, machine learning systems that are much more relevant to the kinds of things he was talking about than say like the, like 1980s rules-based AI would have been. I think to some extent the fact that this rules-based AI turned out not to be very workable is kind of evidence for his position, or supports his position, that like So like to give a bit of background here. So like the more rules-based system would be like you would sort of build an AI system by having explicit rules like pre-programmed that like, so like, you know, you had like chess playing computers, for example, you would like actually, you know, give it the rules of chess and you would give it like principles for like how to like chess strategy, like, you know, don't lose pieces if you can avoid it or something, you know, obviously more detailed than that, but like you would give it sort of like a set of explicit rules that would follow. And one of the sort of major problems that came up with this was that came up with this approach was what was known as the frame problem, which is that like any sort of explicit set of rules that you can give to an AI system to like, you know, handle a certain situation will always sort of presuppose like a background or a frame understanding of things that are not specified by those rules. And so like you would have things like trying to get this AI system to understand like a very simple narrative about like a kid's birthday party, but the if you don't like specify, oh, the cake didn't like explode, or like, you know, the chairs didn't float up into the, you know, the ceiling, if you don't like explicitly tell the computer that, then it doesn't know whether the cake exploded or not. So, you know, obviously a human with like some familiarity with the physics of, you know, cakes and chairs will just assume that the cake did not spontaneously explode, unless you like sort of tell them that the cake did explode, and then the person would probably ask questions about like what this cake was made of. But the AI system has no like, you know, grasp of the physics of cakes unless you build that in. And so like, and of course, like, you know, you could say like, oh, okay, we need to, you know, add cake physics to our AI system, but then, you know, what about the table? Did the table explode? Or like, you know, that any, you could have a million different unlikely circumstances that you have to tell the AI didn't happen. And so like, it's impossible to sort of explicitly write down, you know, here's all the knowledge that you need to know about like the way that the world works to be able to understand like what a kid's birthday party, you know, story like looks like, and answer basic questions about this story, about the story. So I think, so this, like in the sort of 1980s, like as this problem started to, you know, become more, like as the awareness of this problem started to be more prominent, and like the lack of a prospect for solving this problem just by sort of, you know, building in more background knowledge about, you know, cakes not exploding and so on. So as this problem started to become more like obviously intractable, there was like what that's commonly referred to as the AI winter, where like all this funding that like, you know, especially military bodies in the US were providing, and other, you know, government bodies, companies and universities and so on, like you know, the fact that there was this pretty limited, you know, prospect of success led to them sort of pulling a lot of the funding. And then it was only when you started to have like in the late 80s, I guess, and then into the 90s, there was more more focus on, at the time, it was known as like parallel distributed processing. So this is like the sort of neural net architecture, where you would, rather than sort of giving a set of rules that say like, if the shape has such and such properties, then the image is a cat, you would instead just sort of feed it a bunch of images of cats and with a label saying this is a cat, and then a bunch of other images with a label saying this is not a cat, and you would allow the system to like you know, set the parameters of these different, you know, supposed neurons, these units that would result in being able to identify images of cats and distinguish them from non-cats. So you, as a human researcher, you don't have to be able to explain what makes an image look like a cat, or how you can identify a cat from an image. You just sort of feed all these images labeled cat or not cat, and you allow the AI or this machine learning system to learn how to identify cats. And what is also, you know, in some cases kind of disturbing about these systems is that as a researcher, you don't even necessarily know how the system has learned to identify cats. You just sort of can measure that it has a certain accuracy at measuring, at identifying cats from images, but you can't sort of look at the system and say, oh, it's like, it's looking at the shape or the color or whatever. You don't know what it is that the system is actually picking up on to identify cats from non-cats. And of course, this is a very simple sort of image recognition task. But of course, you have much more complicated systems where, you know, making a decision in one way or another could have pretty serious consequences for people. That, like, I know in the US, a lot of states use similar types of systems for, like, bail decisions. That, like, is this person someone we can trust to release on bail or not? Or in healthcare, so, like, you know, should this insurance claim be accepted or not? So, like, they're sort of, you know, taking in information about the person and coming up with a sort of yes or no decision. You know, can we release this person on bail? Yes or no, or whatever. And, you know, big surprise, it often ends up being sort of like a proxy, like the system essentially learns to be racist, that, like, it uses, you know, zip code or something like that as a sort of proxy for the race of the person that is, you know, potentially, you know, up for bail. And it ends up, you know, denying bail or recommending that people be denied bail at a much higher rate if the person is Black than if they're white. So it's not that anyone sort of, you know, told the system, you know, denied bail to Black people, but it has learned to reproduce the existing racism in the legal system and, you know, generate the same sort of racist pattern. Without anyone actually sort of explicitly telling it to do that. These cases are, like, maybe relatively easy to identify because you can actually just sort of count the number of people that, or, like, look at the outcomes. But there are much less obvious cases where you have, like, you know, in the financial system, you know, something, a transaction getting flagged as fraud or potential fraud or whatever, you know, based on all kinds of factors that you are not even aware of, or, like, you submit an insurance claim and it gets denied, but it's, you know, that could be based on, you know, I don't know, who you're friends with on Facebook, or, like, where your car, you know, was tracked to have gone, or, like, all sorts of things that you would never think are relevant to your insurance claim. But, like, you know, just this sort of churn of data has, like, you know, brought in all these different factors and identified that, you know, a person who, like, I don't know, posts pictures of cakes that don't explode on Instagram is, like, X percent more likely to submit a fraudulent insurance claim for healthcare services. So your insurance claim gets flagged as potentially fraudulent because of something you posted on Instagram 5 years ago, or, I don't know, like, these random things that you would normally not think are at all relevant.
Yeah. On the the point about the image recognition AIs, I think Ruye would probably feel validated by the fact that, you know, even though they are much better than like old-fashioned AI at recognizing images, you know, as we've talked about in this group, like CAPTCHA images, which are used to, you know, ensure that a person accessing a website is a person and not a machine, you know, where you select pictures of bicycles, for instance, from somewhat unusual angles or the pictures. It's never, like, difficult to tell that it's a bus, for instance, or a bicycle or a crosswalk. But it is still difficult for, like, image recognition AIs to determine that these are pictures of bicycles or crosswalks or whatever. And that does seem to indicate that there's still, you know, at least in some situations, this recognition of universals problem.
Yeah, and there was that infamous case of the Tesla that someone was, you know, putting on autopilot as Tesla likes to market it as, that drove into the side of a truck that was, like, crashed and was, like, perpendicular to the road, just because this, you know, the training data of the autopilot system had never, like, included you know, a truck blocking the road, and so the car just had no reason to, like, you know, identify that this is an obstacle that you should not drive into, and it just drove right into it. I think the CAPTCHA thing is interesting too, because it seems like in the last couple of years, they've gotten increasingly difficult where, yeah, of course, you still have those like more straightforward ones where it's like identify a crosswalk that are not that hard. But then I got one recently that was like a bunch of like grainy pictures of animals. And then it was like, click the animals that have the same coat as this example image. And it was like a deer and a tiger. And then there were a bunch of fish. And like, I sort of had to guess, like, I guess they mean fur is like what they mean by has the same coat. And yeah, it was very weird. Yeah, so some of them are getting like, you know, harder and involve more, I guess, like semantics than just, so a crosswalk, like there have been some cases of, or like some sort of benchmark examples where you have an AI image recognition system that was able to beat certain CAPTCHA, like, you know, systems that are in place now. But like, so these ones like identify the animal that has the same coat. And as I've gotten pretty often these ones where it's like identify the animal that is in the same position as the example animal. So either like standing or sitting or whatever. So here you have to not just, you know, recognize the word crosswalk and then identify images that have a crosswalk in them, but you have to like, I guess, have a semantic understanding of, you know, what it means for an animal to be standing or sitting. And then, you know, identify that like a sitting goat is in the same position as a sitting dog. And sort of, yeah, so use this more like semantic grasp of a situation as opposed to just, you know, identifying the meaning of a word and, you know, tagging the image that corresponds to that word. So yeah, I think it's likely that like, yeah, this sort of basic image recognition of crosswalks, even from different angles and, you know, grainy photos and so on, is going to increasingly, is going to get better and better, probably pretty quickly over the next few years. And then we're going to see the CAPTCHA moving more towards some kind of, yeah, semantic understanding, obviously not like super sophisticated, but like at least being able to grasp that, yeah, a sitting goat is the same posture as a sitting dog or whatever. And then maybe eventually we'll get to the point where we have to, you know, read a story about a kid's birthday party and answer whether the cake has exploded as a test of whether it's a human or not. Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, so like sort of, I guess the like message that we can draw from this sort of like process is that this sort of open-ended, you know, learning capacity that humans have is still sort of in practical use to distinguish humans from AI systems as they exist today, where like, yeah, you can ask a human to like, you know, look at these weird, you know, grainy photos or like, you know, letters that have lines through them and are at different angles and so on. And humans can still figure out how to do this in a way that, you know, the computer vision system that was trained on like normal text with the letters in normal positions and not having lines through them and so on, is not capable of sort of extrapolating from the from that knowledge. And so like a human learns not just like, you know, this sort of statistical pattern of, you know, dark versus light on a page, but sort of grasp the shape of a letter and is capable of recognizing that shape even when it is in like a different orientation or, you know, is obscured by lines and so on. Yeah, so the human is sort of extracting something from the training or the input that it receives by, you know, reading a bunch of text that the computer is still not capable of extracting at this point. I was joking with a friend a while ago about like how I wanted to like write a science fiction story where like the AI apocalypse comes about through like increasingly sophisticated CAPTCHA processes, as opposed to like the Terminator thing where AI decides to like kill all humans or something. It would be like input the nuclear launch codes to prove that you're a human being or something. Okay, so yeah, we reached the end of this chapter and we're sort of approaching the end of the allotted time for this meeting as well. So yeah, we can end here and pick up at the beginning of chapter 2. So yeah, we'll be talking about framing activities and framed mechanisms. So this is like one of the sort of central arguments that he has made already in this book that we're going to look at in more detail, is the fact that, you know, all these sort of mechanisms and these, you know, machine learning processes and so on are set up with like a certain, you know, set of parameters by a human. The human sort of frames the system and says like it will take images as input and produce this kind of output, like a label cat or not cat. And of course, if you, you know, input a music file, it will, you know, give you an error message or make a very strange determination of whether this piece of music is a cat or not. It won't give like a good response to this input of music. So like this sort of framing of the problem to be solved is performed by the human, and then the mechanism, no matter how sophisticated, has to operate within that frame. Okay. So we'll talk about that next week. Thanks everyone for your participation this week, and hope to see you next week.